Hey guys, so we've made it to episode 5. It only took 8 months.
Unicorns Burnt Pixels Podcast.
5, for some reason, feels like a milestone. I don't know. I laugh, but when I said that I wanted to do a podcast with no real timeline, I didn't think episodes would be so spaced apart. But hey, glad to have you here. This week, this episode, this installment, I guess, would be most appropriate. I'll be getting into a topic that, had you told me just a few years ago, I'd be talking about in any capacity, let alone a positive one, I'd have told you that you were full of shit, because math, and that is what I'm talking about today. I mean, yeah, it's one of those subjects back when I was in school that I really struggled with, and I just don't have a single positive memory of, which, knowing what I know now, I think is a real shame and a real failure on the part of the education system that I was a part of. But no hard feelings, because I found my way back to something that it turns out I'm really into. And yeah, it still feels a bit weird for me to even say that, but okay, so why did I change my mind about math? Spoiler, creative coding played a huge part. So creative coding and computer graphics in general is literally all about math. People say that it's not, but don't be fooled. Also, don't be scared off. I've talked about this on the podcast before. There's really no getting around it. It intimidated the hell out of me when I first came to coding. I got very excited about the processing ecosystem because it claimed to be this kind of bridge for artists to get into coding, but I saw pretty quickly that there were just a lot of formulae being thrown around, and at the time, this kind of gutted me because I still believed that non-math people were like real, which is a total lie, FYI, and we'll be coming back to that in a minute, but I basically thought you could be born with a brain that just wasn't suited for math. So I almost walked away from creative coding, and in my career as a creative coder, I've often wondered if I came at it at the worst possible time or the best possible time, because I started learning to code and then started working professionally as a creative dev around the era of JavaScript fatigue. Like, I landed right in the middle of it all. And so for those of you who might not know what I'm talking about, it was 2015, 2016-ish. There was like this general, very palpable feeling of overwhelm in the web development community because there were all of these frameworks being touted as the next big thing, and no one could decide which one was going to be the one that would shine the brightest. So no one really knew which one to invest their time into learning and updating their code bases. The dust has, of course, since settled, thank God, and people have come around to the idea that there is no one framework to rule them all, no one singular right answer for every possible context and or problem, which is such an analogy for life. But yeah, in contrast to that whole situation in the creative coding community, it seemed like there were MOOCs for things like data visualization, WebGL, and creative coding in general just popping up everywhere. And MOOC is an acronym for Massive Open Online Courses, in case I've lost anyone. One of my absolute favorites is, and this isn't sponsored or anything, but Cadenzae. I always wonder if I'm saying that right, but it's an amazing platform full of classes that you can take or audit. And I mean, I tend to audit because my life is not so organized that I can take the classes and like hand things in on time. Your girl is a working girl. There's only so much time in the day. So yeah, I mainly audit. And back then there were these two classes in particular, an intro to P5.js and then a more advanced P5 class that basically ran through Dan Schiffman's Nature of Code book, which he originally wrote for processing, and in this class ported everything over to JavaScript, which I was so excited about because I knew how great Dan was at teaching. And okay, so for those of you who don't know, Dan Schiffman is like the Bob Ross of creative coding. And I really hope we all know who Bob Ross is, because he is gold. He's like a pure gem and a total legend. And no joke, my sister and I used to wake up super early on Saturday mornings and just watch him on PBS painting all of his little trees.
Ready to have some fun? Let's do it. Just a little though. Don't overdo. it gets working and it feels good, and next thing you know, you've overdone it. But I wanna get you to try being creative on canvas, just to take your time and sit down, have nothing in mind when you start. Just have a good feeling and be happy and in love with life and your world, and sit down and begin playing. And if you feel good about yourself and the world, it'll show in your painting, and all these little things will happen. If you happen to get some of it down in here, who cares? We'll end up turning that into reflections. We don't make mistakes. We have happy accidents. Just don't worry about it. Learn how to use what happens.
I will link him in the notes, guys. He's just a relic of the, I want to say, 80s. The internet rightfully loves him. He's just, yeah, one of those special people. And to that effect, so is Dan Schiffman. He's basically the guy who undid years of math trauma for me.
Welcome to another coding train coding challenge. And in this challenge, whoa, this train is really loud. Can you please pull out of the station now? On the train are roses. Because one thing that I really like are flowers, and there's so wonderful mathematical algorithms that you can get to make these beautiful rose-like patterns, and you can see even here all sorts of different possibilities. So I've been really interested in tiling and symmetry, and I'm hoping to do many more videos about different topics like that, and this is kind of along those lines. So this is actually something that I could do with just this incredibly simple formula, where r equals cosine of k times theta. So what does that formula mean? We're going to have to figure that out first.
My whole obsession with code has been, and continues to be, the creative potential and being able to programmatically generate visuals that have an IRL kind of feel and texture about them. Any of you guys that have actually listened since 5 episodes ago know that I've always been mesmerized by the idea of making things move around in digital space in a way that feels natural, that feels like the thing moving has its own personality, like its own purpose. And Schiffman's Nature of Codebook and class literally takes natural processes and replicates them with code, and basically he empowers us to take math and physics formulae. I really feel like I'm somehow not talking about this the right way. I think where I've managed to shake any imposter syndrome I've been lugging around as a coder new to the field, I definitely still have a healthy amount of it when it comes to discussing math and science things. But is imposter syndrome ever healthy? Anyways, let's just go with formulas, guys. So Dan basically teaches us how to apply them to, well, whatever you want to apply them to. And the thing about the math involved here is that on the one hand, like I said, you can't really animate anything in computer graphics without it. So if that's your goal, you're gonna have to put in the time. But on the flip side, since you get visual feedback of what you're coding, the math kind of makes more sense in a way. I guess the visual feedback helps develop my intuition anyways about the formulas at play. And let's talk about intuition for a sec. This time last year, I was doing a really fun digital book club, and it was with Dan Schiffman and organized by the P5JS Diversity Initiative in collaboration with Princeton Studio Lab. And it was open to anyone around the world who wanted to take part. So I did. We were reading Seymour Papert's book, Mindstorms, which I highly recommend to anyone, to everyone. It's really, really good. The book uses the Logo Turtle, which is basically a kind of kid-friendly coding language, to illustrate how computers can be used as educational instruments, especially when it comes to developing math intuition. The author's whole argument is that computers basically enhance creativity and innovation within the learning process. And yeah, he basically makes a really strong case for everyone being a math person, and makes a super strong case against the educational system kind of just catering to one type of learner, which, yeah, I definitely was not and am not that type of learner. I actually wrote a few pieces about this book and the book club on Medium, which I will link if anyone's curious. But yeah, so basically, guys, everyone is a math person. It just takes an angle of personal interest to make math accessible to anyone, because you just have to be, yeah, interested in why numbers are doing certain things. Like, it has to mean something to you in a personal kind of way, and then you'll want to understand, and paths will kind of open up in your mind and lead you there, at least to some degree. And the rest is learning, which is made so much more easier when you're doing it for a cause that's self-motivated, instead of trying to just like memorize things for the sake of passing a test or something. So none of this, I'm not a math person business anymore, okay guys? And someone at some point described math to me, I think I read it somewhere actually, as the language of nature. this thing that had for so long been for me this like cold kind of inaccessible thing, I keep saying thing, that I just wasn't, you know, blessed with the right gray matter to tackle. It turns out it's the language of the natural world, which to me has always felt like something I'm connected to on an intuitive kind of level, which might skew a little too into the woo-woo realm for some. But I mean, guys, what feels better on your skin than a light breeze on a hot day? Am I right? And that breeze is a fluid that by definition flows. And actually the fact that it flows is what quantifies it as a fluid. So yeah, air is a fluid. And that flow, you can calculate that and replicate it in a system of your own creation. In hindsight though, I have to say that I disagree with the idea that math is the language of nature. I think that math is like the distillation of the ingredients that comprise nature into data. So math and data, what about textures? I'm really interested slash kind of obsessed with the idea of generating textures digitally that don't necessarily immediately reflect the technology behind them. I like the optical illusion, trompe-l'œil, suspension of disbelief quality that lifelike digital textures have, which is why I've recently gotten into shaders. Over the last few months, I've been slowly but surely reading and rereading my way through Patricio Gonzalez's book of shaders, which is basically the shader Bible. And I will definitely link it if anyone's interested. The whole entire thing is available online. And Patricio, who is one of the coolest internet friends I've come in contact with, and side note, but this has been either my immense good luck or, and this is how I prefer to think of it, but the immensely good-natured vibe that kind of permeates the creative coding community as a whole. People, in my experience, are just really friendly and happy to discuss techniques and ideas and just like sending little bumps of encouragement in a DM. I guess everyone is sensitive to the minutiae involved in the pursuit of creative expression in digital form. It's not for the faint of heart. And at the same time, I noticed just a lot of like friendliness, and there's just way less of the I struggled to figure this shit out, so you should too, kind of attitude that is definitely a thing in more corporate coding circles. Anyways, that was just a bit of a tangent slash love letter to my community. So shaders, a language that is entirely different from JavaScript. Like, these languages are miles apart. Shaders is written in OpenGL shading language, aka GLSL, and actually looks more like a C-type language. I won't get into the technical details about it on the podcast because this is supposed to be a theory-only zone, but should any of you be curious about how to get started with shaders, I did write myself a bunch of notes on the topic in the form of a three-part series of blog posts outlining how to get up and running with shaders using 3JS, and as tradition would have it, I of course incorporated some audio visualization into the mix, so if any of that piques your curiosity, check out the show notes. The thing with shaders and WebGL and any graphic animation, like I said, you've got to do the math, and with Dan Schiffman's Nature of Code, I got my hands dirty with vector math, which was, yeah, totally new for me. Walking through things with Dan, who just explains everything in such a state of like general excitement and enthusiasm, it's hard to find the time to doubt yourself because you're so caught up in how excited he is to explain everything and like all the possibilities that trickle out of this knowledge he's imparting on you. He also happily makes mistakes in some of his live episodes on YouTube, which totally destigmatized things for me. I'm telling you, if you haven't seen an episode of Coding Train on his YouTube channel, you're missing out.
Hello! I should let you know, I'm about to do a coding challenge. You're gonna watch this, apparently. And I have been live streaming for 3.5 hours, so I apologize in advance.
He's basically given me just enough confidence in my ability to like assimilate math concepts that I figured I could handle whatever math surprises that might await me over in Shaderland, which led me to, well, I kind of had like an epiphany. Patricio wrote in the Book of Shaders that it's difficult to describe all the relationships between trigonometric functions and circles. And he features this amazing GIF of a sine function and a cosine function, which resembles, if you were to picture a roller coaster, the peaks and valleys. And the GIF basically has these peaks and valleys tracing a circle. I'll, of course, link the GIF, but this image really bothered me because, I mean, it's really beautiful. And I remember seeing this in high school and not getting it then. And this time I really wanted to get it. I wanted to intuitively understand it. And full disclosure, part of me is still totally cringing at the idea that anyone relatively well-versed in mathematics is listening right now, because I'm sure my very entry-level expertise here is going to yield the least elegant explanation of things, but since we're here. So shaders relies on a lot of linear algebra. You're dealing with vectors, matrices, spatial distribution systems, and that's systems plural because you have both Cartesian and polar coordinates to play around with. And that means sometimes dealing with angles and other times with radians, which are two parallel but different ways of understanding the radius and circumference of a circle. And in the midst of it all, you have a triangle kind of like guiding everything. And that's a right triangle, of course. We're talking like old school trig, Pythagorean theorem, which finds itself at the epicenter of all the calculations that I've been confronted with, at least so far. And it just kind of all boils down to leveraging the theorem and its all-important triangle to kind of trace a circle of points whose positions are known and can be plotted all the way around the circle. And that circle, well, you can kind of unfurl it into a waveform, which would give us the beautiful GIF I mentioned. I feel like I just threw some very shaky, very mathy smoke and mirrors at you guys. Patricio is right. It's not easy to describe the relationships between trigonometric functions and circles. It's definitely easier to see them, though. And if you're really interested in the details, I've actually got a mini series going at the moment on the blog about stackable math concepts. So simple math concepts that are useful for animating fragment shaders. The idea is to like really develop my math intuition and so that I can just kind of get more playful when I'm coding and have that freedom that comes with, yeah, knowing that you understand what is making the things you're creating actually do the things that they're doing. I think too that having like a go-to set of tools better allows us as artists to kind of configure an ecosystem to create in and then hopefully from there really tweak and perfect a style or aesthetic. It's something Zach Lieberman mentioned last year when he came to Paris and gave a talk at Parsons, actually. The importance of creating a creative framework for yourself inside which you develop your own shortcuts, which in turn creates this kind of magical space where like an aesthetic or a style emerges. So, okay, my epiphany. I realized that basically my hang up all these years about math had been that I didn't understand all the hopping between like universes, for lack of a better term. I don't think I even followed that we were in fact jumping around. There's angles and radians and polar coordinates and Cartesian coordinates and normalization along with unit vectors and then the unit circle, which is actually for me where everything started to make sense and click into place with the GIF I mentioned earlier. I wonder why in school things don't just start there, like with the unit circle. Or again, maybe they did and I blocked it out. But it turns out that all the different bits, like pieces of this what feels like a massive math puzzle aren't actually like separate from each other. Instead, they're kind of like layered on top of one another. I think of it like layers in Photoshop, actually, if you've ever done like a mask. You can kind of blend things between layers and get specific outcomes that otherwise are impossible. And in the same way, when you pair certain bits from different, I guess, math contexts together in equations, you're given access to types of information that wouldn't be available otherwise. That you can then use to, yeah, do stuff. But okay, do stuff. What does that even mean, Eliza? Well, it means that a frequency, aka a sinusoidal function, is also a circle. And the rate of frequency, or time it takes to trace around the edge of the circle, can be calculated using the Pythagorean theorem, whose data can be utilized to create movement, for example. You can do things like animate shapes. You can fade colors into each other with it, or you can make sound. What is a frequency, really? As we've seen at this point, the simplest, most bare-bones explanation would be how often something occurs within a time frame, like how many times you can trace around the circle in a certain amount of time, how many peaks and valleys in your sinusoidal function will appear in a given amount of time, so how many cycles take place. Speaking in terms of sound, if you have like 180 drum beats occurring per minute, then the time interval between beats is about like a third of a second. You have 3 beats per second, so 3 cycles per second. And to take things one step further, sound is like, well, it's an invisible form of energy made by vibrations, which we feel thanks to their capacity to move around the air that we're steeped in. And air, like I mentioned, is actually a fluid, right? This air fluid that we live in, it gets pushed around by different actors like vibrations emitted by sounds. And there is, of course, a proper scientific term for this whole fluid getting pushed around business. called a sound wave. And a sound wave will push air around over here, which will in turn push air around over there, setting kind of a domino effect of air pushing into motion until enough air has been pushed around that it gets pushed into our ear and makes its way to our eardrum. And well, then there's a bunch of inner ear geometry meets hair cells, meets the firing of neurons in our brains that gets set into motion. And this is what allows our minds to register that we are hearing the sound wave, which we then use to decide whether or not the vibrations are nice sounds or not. And actually, the ability to judge the beauty of sound can also be traced back to Pythagoras, who had a whole theory about musical harmony that ties into his theorem. He did a bunch of experiments relating to string instruments and the length and tension of strings being plucked, which of course generated sounds. I'm quoting from one of my favorite books now called A Beautiful Question, written by Frank Wilczek. He won the Nobel Prize for Physics back in 2004. And he describes Pythagoras' experiment like this. In all instruments, there is a principal tone or pitch that we recognize as the note being played. Pythagoras discovered that the pitch obeys two remarkable rules. Rules that make direct connections among numbers, properties of the physical world, and our sense of harmony. Pythagoras' first rule is a relationship between the length of the vibration string and our perception of its tone. The rule says that two copies of the same type of string, both subject to the same tension, make tones that sound good together precisely when the lengths of the string are in ratios of small whole numbers. What Pythagoras discovered then is that the perceived harmonies of tones reflect relationships in what might seem to be an entirely different world, the world of numbers. Pythagoras' second rule involves the tension of the strings. The tones are in harmony if the tensions are ratios of squares of small whole numbers. Higher tensions correspond to higher pitches. Along with the Pythagorean theorem on right triangles, these two rules of musical consonants together link shape, size, weight, and harmony, with the common thread being number. Now, I would personally go even further than that, saying that since the source of musical sound is vibrations, which can be mapped via a sine function, which is plain old trig, we've got a bit of a full circle moment happening here, which I find quite charming. I do enjoy when the dots line up or connect, because circles, lines, whatever. Anyways, the thing I like about Pythagoras' harmony theory, or theories, I guess, is that they imply that basically we are predicting the ratios intuitively in a way, since harmony assumes a pleasurable sound. Or I guess a better way to explain it is to say, like, we default guesstimate what we're hearing to be in harmony or not. So like when all the neurons start firing in our brains, once the sound waves hit us, we basically either lean in or recoil, right? It's rarely something we need to stop and think about. Though, devil's advocate, I've definitely been confronted by music that has left me wondering whether or not I liked what I was hearing. But there are cultural things that have to do with why certain people might enjoy or dislike sounds, based on things like the tones in the languages they speak. And you can certainly train an ear to appreciate combinations of tones too. So I just find this kind of thing super interesting, because it speaks a great deal to like how we see the world and how the world can totally be shaped by things entirely unseen, and how quickly we forget that perception spans like much wider than what we see with our eyes. And numbers and data and math allows us to map all of this confusing, interesting, natural phenomena out and play with it and experiment. And yeah, so hopefully my super long ramble about math, with the usual shout out to sound tacked on for free, inspires anyone who may be hesitant to try to use code creatively because of the math factor. Like, it really shouldn't be the thing that stops you. So okay, slight pivot now. This podcast is an experiment, right? It's a place for me to put the more theoretical thoughts about why I'm so interested in using all the code I dig through on my blog for my creative aspirations. Well, one of the biggest inspirations I had for making this podcast was that A, I figured that people are just more prone to listen to a girl wax poetic about random theoretical tech art stuff online than read it online. The internet in the past decade has become a place to go when you're looking for like how to do something, or how to contact someone, or for more visual inspiration. And I guess it feels like less of a place for people to go to really explore just for the sake of exploring. I'm talking in terms of reading specifically, and I could definitely be wrong about this. I'm basing everything I'm saying right now entirely off of my own experience, but I know for myself that I prefer reading a real book, or okay, my Kindle is about the closest thing to a screen you can get me to read on, But that could also be because I spent all day coding, so I'm so ready to get off a screen when I'm called to read anything that isn't documentation. But that was a really long-winded A when I was really just trying to get to B, which, okay, so the second major inspiration for this podcast was Good Point, which was this great conversation between two artists, Raphael Rosendahl and Jeremy Bailey, spread across weekly podcast episodes. And I say was with the heaviest of hearts, because Raphael and Jeremy just announced that they are putting Good Point on a hiatus indefinitely. And they say hiatus, but it really sounded as though they were closing a chapter. I get it. I mean, the podcast ran for 91 episodes and they raised some really good points, pun totally intended, for why they're stopping, including one that really kind of stuck with me and made me momentarily doubt this podcast. Raphael was saying that he felt like when he talked about ideas too much, he was less productive / inspired to do his own work, because in a way, talking about something kind of removed the need to explore it further through visual work to a certain degree, I guess. So it made me wonder if I wasn't stifling myself with this auditory space that I've created. I'll include links to Raphael Rosendahl and Jeremy Bailey and their podcast in the show notes for you guys to check out. The back catalog of episodes is totally worth it. But yeah, I had to think about it for a few days because I really get what Raphael is saying. The whole, if you talk about it too much, you end up not really doing the thing, right? Has anyone else ever had that experience? It's something that actually comes up a lot in creative circles, I find. Like, you don't want to talk about your next project idea for fear it'll like curse it somehow or feel less worthy of the effort. Because extracting the idea from inside your head and like giving birth to it IRL is a whole ordeal that takes time and a lot of energy, and often for results that don't necessarily look like what you actually had in mind. So you kind of have to commit to it, I guess, for better or for worse. And this is totally turning into another tangent, when what I really was trying to say was just that this podcast of mine, it's a place that, looking back over the last 5 whole episodes, has actually done the opposite of what I suppose Raphael was feeling about Good Point. And maybe if I get to 91 episodes, I'll say different. But for now, it's definitely something that has turned out to be a way for me to take time and dive really deep into the edges of my interests. So hats off to Good Point, Raphael and Jeremy. It was so, so good while it lasted. And in the wake of Good Point, this podcast will continue to be the best excuse I have for taking the time. All right, so last thing. In honor of this apparently milestone episode, I've actually switched podcast providers, hosts, is that the right term? I used to use Spreaker, but after a certain point, they make you pay, and I'm just a total product of my generation, a true believer that most, if not all, things online should be free. So when I heard about Anchor, which is totally forever free, I decided to switch. And why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this because they have this thing as part of their service where listeners can record voice memo responses to podcast episodes. And I thought that that was pretty cool. So yeah, in honor of this 5th episode, you can now, should you feel so inclined, leave me questions, comments, suggestions, what have you. And if anyone does, I might pick some now and again and include them in follow-up episodes. So yeah, feel free to drop a girl a line. Trolls, not welcome. Otherwise, anything is fair game. You just have to find the app in the App Store, and normally there's like a button in the app and that lets you send me a voice memo. Cool. So thanks, as always, for listening, everyone. Let's see if we can round out the year with 6 episodes. All right. See you in the next one.
Unicorns for Pixels Podcast.